Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are back. And we've got a full house tonight, and I mean really full. We've got an extremely august panel here. And, of course, most august of all is my co-host, Sam Bradley.
I am august because it is finally spring, I think, in Colorado. It's been close to the 70s after having a blizzard only a couple weeks ago. So I'm hoping that will hold on and will. My grass is actually starting to grow. So we have quite a panel tonight, which we'll introduce in just a minute. But in the meantime, we have our meteorologist, Becky DePodwin. And is this anything major going on this week, or has Mother Nature finally settled down some?
It's been pretty quiet. The two things I was going to mention were the hailstorm in Texas that happened on Sunday and is likely going to cost, 300 to 400 million. Unfortunately, fortunately, that's pretty par for the course for Texas for this part of the year. And the other major news story in the world was these floods in Iran, if you guys heard about this. But so far, it looks like around 32 people have been killed, 100 people injured. Some of the videos coming out of Iran, it's just absolutely insane, the amount of water. They've had 3 inches of rain in 36 hours, and their normal for the entire month is around 2 inches. So pretty extreme for that part of the world, and unfortunately has taken some lives. But otherwise, fairly quiet across the rest of the U.S., maybe some storms later this week. Continuing flood threat for the middle part of the country, coastal flood threat for parts of the Northeast. But overall, I think March is going to go out like a lamb, which is the reverse of that phrase. I don't remember. And like, yeah, a lamb, not like a lamb. No, it's about right.
That's right. Well, we wouldn't have thought that a couple weeks ago with that storm coming through. Yeah, I remember reading something about the hailstorm. It was like quarter-size hail. Oh, you know how I love hail. Anyway, Dr. Joe, you got some of that weather down there in Tennessee, didn't you?
We did just a little bit. We got a little bit of rain, but it passed quickly, and it's cooled off a little. But other than that, it's actually been fairly nice.
Good deal. So, Lee, how's the weather down there in Australia?
Well, at the moment, it's a nice warm day. It's about 25 degrees centigrade down here at the moment, wet and rainy, because we've had some a couple of cyclones around the country. In the state I'm in, Queensland, we had Cyclone Trevor go across the top, across the Carpentaria, the Gulf of Carpentaria, and is now coming back down as a tropical low in the central part of Queensland, dumping a lot of water into the farmland areas where the farmers have had a drought for the last 10 years, and they're just happy as to have this amount of rain being dropped on them. So, yeah, at the moment it's very humid, very warm, it's raining outside, but hopefully it's starting to get cooler for us down here. It's been over and above average in temperatures. The nights are still in 25 degrees centigrade at night. So, yeah, that's Australia weather for you. It's extremes.
Well, we certainly had extremes here. It's like having our own meteorologist down under. So here's our theme for tonight. Lee is one of our community members on Facebook, and he posed a question about Safety Third, which we've discussed that article. And we were kind of interested in how that worked elsewhere. He's also a wilderness specialist, which he'll tell us about in a second, but we thought it would be kind of neat to get him on here to discuss that with a couple of the authors from that article. And we have Chris Davis with us again and Sarah Frances McClure. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going? Good to be back.
So, Chris, real quick, do you want to give them a little tiny bio in case they hadn't heard you before?
Sure. So I'm Chris Davis. I'm a EMS physician and emergency physician in North Carolina at Wake Forest University. I kind of split my time between working in the community as an emergency doc and then also working with the various EMS services here around Western North Carolina as assistant medical director, as a flight physician on our aircraft, and as a wilderness EMS physician, working very closely with Seth Hawkins with some of our mountain rescue teams. I also do a lot of education in wilderness medicine, both with the nonprofit and with our university department. And we're in the process of starting a fellowship in wilderness medicine here at Wake Forest as well. So I don't do very much. I have lots of free time, not busy at all.
So, Dr. Joe.
Like everybody else, yeah.
Seriously. Sarah Francis, you want to tell us a little about you?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm a second-year emergency medicine resident in New York City, but prior to going to medical school, I was a paramedic and did Watercliff and Cave Rescue in Tennessee as well. So just enjoying the wilderness that is New York City.
It is a wilderness.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, that's a wilderness that scares me more than any anywhere else.
Seriously.
For sure.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a lot in common with Lee, you know, flight medicine and air medicine and wilderness. So, Lee, let's just jump right in. I want to hear about your background and where you've lived and worked and some of the things you're doing.
All right. Well, that's a long story, but I'll try and keep it short. I'm an advanced care paramedic level 2 in Australia in a generic state ambulance service. I originally started as an EMT in the UK, and I've been now in the EMS service for 17 years. I've done my training over in the UK, went from EMT to paramedic in 2.5 years, got registered with the Healthcare and Professions Council in the UK, which all paramedics have to do. And then the ambulance service I work for now came over to the UK to recruit international paramedics to fill a skill gap that they had over here as they were transitioning from trained staff in their own service to university paramedics. So they built up a big gap between qualified paramedics and EMT. So they brought up over a lot of international. So they sponsored me and my wife to come over, and we're now citizens of Australia through that scheme. And I've been here ever since. While I was in the UK, I done 3 years on the Essex Air Ambulance Service, which is one of the counties on the border of London. So we flew in and out of London quite a bit doing jobs. I also was a specialist in chemical decontamination for the decontamination teams and was a trainer in that. And I'm getting back into that now. Over here is hopefully in the next 2 months, I'll be taking my advanced hazmat life support course to get myself back into that and a trainer as a chemical decontamination specialist. But other than that, I've worked regional and rural in Australia out to small towns with only a population of 200 covering a 10,000 square kilometer area as the only advanced life support paramedic in that area. And I've also worked on Fraser Island. If you Google Fraser Island, you'll see it's an absolutely beautiful paradise of a place, the biggest sand island in the world. No roads other than sand tracks. Everything's done by 4x4. We've got a Land Cruisers that we use. I only have one paramedic on the island most of the time, but when it does get busy, so when the population on the island gets over 15,000 people, so this is all holiday makers, backpackers, and school holidays, coming on to stay on the island, they bring in a second one. So there's really only two paramedics that would deal with that massive population in a very demanding environment, because it's all ruled by the tides and the weather to whether we can get to people. Now, we could, you know, there could be a job 35 kilometers away up a beach that could take us 6-7 hours to get to it. So, yeah, that's generally me. And I'm really getting into the wilderness medicine now, part of a group of doctors being supported by University of Colorado School of Medicine, bringing advanced wilderness life support training now down into the Southern Hemisphere. So international people can come over and enjoy our country, get a good qualification from it, and from there. So, yeah, that's Lee in a nutshell, really.
Wow. Well, I might raise my hand for that Fraser Island duty. That doesn't sound like a bad place to be. And you've worked as a flight medic, I remember, in your bio there. So you're involved with AWLS. You want to explain to folks what that's about?
Well, Advanced Wilderness Life Support is a qualification you can get from the AWLS.org. It's delivered by many different entities, universities, private organizations can deliver this from their curriculum. And it is basically teaching people how to do prolonged field care, improvise and adapt out in the field with people with trauma or medical issues that may arise when they're out in the wilderness. So anywhere back country, not front country, and you've got a prolonged time before you can get a patient to definitive care from that point. So it's also helps with expedition medicine as well. So I started off doing, I'll get my basic wilderness life support qualification over in Nepal. I went over there with an organization and we done a trek up to the Annapurna base camp whilst being trained. So it's showing us how we would evaluate a patient from point of injury to how to evacuate them and get them to, as I say, a place of definitive care, either by land, by air, or by sea. It's not well known down here in Australia, so there is another organisation down here delivering it as well. But the way it's being delivered is the way we're delivering it is different to the way they are as well. They're more of a resort delivery where we are delivering the curriculum actually out in the field, so people get more of an experience from that as well. And being supported by, say, Colorado University, which is one of the world leaders in wilderness medicine and expedition medicine as well.
I love the Colorado connection, you and me. There you go. So, Chris, you guys have a lot of experiential stuff going on, too, like with your externship. You want to tell us about that real quick?
Yeah, there's quite a few things that we've got going on kind of here in the Southeast United States through various organizations. Kind of my nexus for all of that is with Wake Forest University and our Division of Wilderness Medicine and EMS. We've got an externship. It's a kind of a play on the typical, medical term. You know, an internship is what you would do for your training. But we have an externship as kind of a pun, is that we try to keep the trainees completely outside and outside of the hospital. They, kind of, it's a 1 month experience that is for either fourth medical students or emergency medicine residents, and it is a fully experiential learning experience where we insert the externs into a wilderness EMS system in Burke County, which is in western North Carolina in the Appalachian Mountains. It's home to the deepest gorge east of the Mississippi and one of the highest search and rescue volumes per capita in the eastern United States. So the externs spend an entire month, inserted as responding members of the Wilderness EMS team there, really learning from our special operations paramedics working alongside of them, and living out this motto that we have called Esse Quam Videre, which is the state motto of North Carolina and translates from the Latin, which means to be rather than to seem to be. So we really take that to heart and think, there's no better way to learn about hypothermia than to be out in the field and getting cold and taking care of somebody and feeling that, rather than just sitting around and listening to PowerPoints. So that's an experience that is open to any fourth year medical students or any emergency medicine residents. And the applications are actually due for next year on April 1st. So if anyone's interested in that, that is something coming up. They can find out more about that at Hawk Ventures, website hawkventures.org. Some other things we've got going on in the region. We've got, I'm involved with a nonprofit called Blue Ridge Adventure Medicine, where we're hosting lots of different courses, including AWLS in the Southeast. And we've got all kinds of different educational opportunities for medical students, residents, paramedics in prolonged field care, wilderness medicine. Our missions there are to provide realistic simulation training, interdisciplinary educational opportunities and to do it all at a like really reasonable price. So, that's at BlueRidgeAdventureMedicine.com, BlueRidgeAdventureMed.com, and HawkVentures.com. We can provide links to all this stuff in the, in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that. Sarah Francis, were you involved in that externship program?
Yes, I was fortunate to be one of the externs in 2016. It was really incredible experience. I remember the first day where we were handed a pager, a radio, and a light for the car. And it was just kind of like, go, do your thing. But what it's turned into is an incredible mentorship among paramedics, EMTs, firefighters, search and rescue personnel, and other physicians. And it's just growing and snowballing, this mentorship and group that kind of creates this niche of emergency or wilderness EMS.
Wow, that's a very cool program. And of course, we all agree experiential training is the best, right, Dr. Joe? That's what you do.
It is absolutely the best and absolutely essential.
Okay, so Lee, well, I guess we ought to do this. Chris, can you just give us a quick overview of what Safety Third, what that concept is all about? Because it's very new, and those of us that have been in EMS for quite a while learned it very differently.
Yeah, this is, you know, I think the concept of Safety Third, it's something that came out of this crucible of, you know, almost, you know, looking at the externship is, you know, I was an extern in 2013 and I've been involved on faculty since, and worked with Sarah Francis and Seth Hawkins, lots of other people kind of on many different projects. But one of the things we were thinking about is this concept of safety. And, you know, boy, it seems like the stuff that we're doing out here in wilderness EMS particularly is not exactly safe. I wouldn't consider any of this stuff that we're doing to be like, you know, as safe as sitting on the couch eating popcorn and watching YouTube videos, you know. But we've been sort of preached this mantra that, you know, safety first, just every time you do an simulation or scenario as an EMT class, you learn to walk in, do some jazz hands, wave your hands in the air and say, all right, I got my BSI on. Is the scene safe? And then someone will say, yes. And they say, okay. And then you go in and you do your simulation and you pass. But we're thinking that the reality is that this is not what it's really like. And this isn't what people really are doing or what they're really thinking as they approach a scene that is inherently dangerous. So we just started thinking, gosh, maybe safety's not first. And we'd heard, you know, there's lots of tongue-in-cheek stuff out there. Oh, safety third, you know, there's T-shirts, people cutting their hands off and stuff. And we had seen actually Mike Rowe was one of the first people that we could see that was really actually using this phrase, but he was using it in a very different way than sort of throw caution to the wind and just have a great time and don't care about safety. But he was kind of thinking about it in the terms of with every banner and sign that he saw in a factory that said safety first, he thought the more that you just kept preaching it over and over and over that safety's first, the more that you just could assume that someone else is looking out for your safety and to get complacent. And that's when he thought that every time he got hurt, it was because he was getting complacent. So we all kind of were talking about this and Gash said, maybe there's something to this idea that we can all assume that safety doesn't seem to be first at all when we're going to do something very dangerous to help someone. So, but how should we realistically think about this rather than just saying, well, if it's dangerous, we're not going, because we know that's just not how we really think, you know? So, we kind of drilled down on what our priorities were and what, you know, what made us feel like we were doing a good job and that made us get up and go to work every day and try to accomplish our goals. And so we kind of settled on this concept that safety is third. First is getting the job done, having a mission-oriented mindset. Two is having fun, so getting it done and having fun. Having fun more so than just going out there and having, you know, actual fun, but really having a sense of job satisfaction, listening to our gut, realizing when things feel really sketchy and we're not having a good time and we're getting really scared and just sort of paying attention that this should be a time to reassess. So this is essentially having situational awareness as our two. And then three being considering the overt safety of what we're doing. But the thing is, when you get into it, it's not a vertical hierarchy whatsoever. You can't have a mission-oriented attitude without doing it in a safe manner. And secondly, you can't be, feeling good about your job or enjoying your work without doing it in some way that you're not constantly getting hurt and not that's not fun to break your arm or, worse. So that's kind of the big picture view of our thought process on all this. And we've been out kind of, we wrote an article about it, been talking to people in the, at conferences and things about it and having really awesome conversations with people, really, as this was sort of meant to just sort of bring up a realistic approach to how we're actually doing risk assessment in the field, which seems to be not how it's being taught in EMS classes.
So, Lee, I want to refer to a short one here, but you said the Australian government is adopting a POP, person, object, place, threat scenario. So I want to hear about that. But it was because of an ongoing risk assessment during jobs, mainly brought in due to assaults on paramedics and the fact we are having a younger age paramedics coming into the service straight out of university with very limited real world experience. So you were thinking it fits right in with the safety third concept in a wilderness environment. Do you want to touch on that for us?
Yes. Over the last few years, there has been significant assaults on paramedics, either on scene or also in the back of the ambulance with the patient, mainly due to drug or alcohol intoxication that we deal with on a daily basis here in the metro areas of Australia. And so what they brought in is this: we're given a very limited kind of self-defense training with the POP threat scenario. And the POP stands for person, object, place. So every time you're walking into a situation, you observe the person or patient, the objects, if there's anything around that can be or cannot be used as a weapon, and the place that you're in. You're not getting yourself into a position where you cannot retreat from the scene that you're in, be it a house in a RTC on the side of a highway or in a public area. And talking with colleagues in the crew rooms on this and putting it into context with the safety third stuff, we all kind of agree that it's a similar sort of scenario, that you're doing your constant evaluation that is constantly changing. Safety is never, you walk in, is the scene safe? Yes, it is. Carry on. It could change. As many times I've been into a house, very dark, dealing with a patient, and then suddenly I stand up and there's somebody standing behind me. I didn't see them come into the room. I didn't hear them come into the room. My safety there is now completely gone. How am I going to now get myself out of that scenario if it goes pear-shaped, or if my crewmate is even there to help me? But working out in the rural areas where I worked in central Queensland for 3 years, I was on my own. I had no second officer with me. I would be going out to places 125, 150 kilometres away. The nearest backup from another ALS crew could be 2 or 3 hours, by air, an hour. So all of that safety third is a fantastic concept, and the way that you're having to now think is, yeah, got the mission done, enjoy yourself while you're doing it, but thinking, how am I going to get away from this if it all goes wrong? So it's great and it's brilliant that it's been highlighted, and now we're all talking about it. I'm using it every day when at work, especially on Fraser as well. Recently we had another cyclone circling around out in the Coral Sea, and it was bringing on some really bad weather onto the coast, and it completely decimated the whole beach up Fraser Island, which is a designated road when it's on low tide. Everybody uses it. It goes up and down. It's like our motorway. Had to get to a patient at the top of the island who was borderline septic. And that took us 5 hours. And we had to go through an inland track that nobody really uses. There was two of us in the vehicle because of the weather event that came through. Big giggle for both of us driving through this area, having to stop, clear fallen trees with chainsaws that we happen to have in the ambulance as well, and get there to only get 20 kilometers up the beach. And we sat there and thought, well, this has taken us 4 hours to get here. We could have just stayed at the station for 4 hours and waited for the tide to go out and then maybe go up the beach. But the tide was, even though out, was still so far up the beach that it was pushing us into the dunes, and we was having waves hitting the side of the Land Cruiser as we was going up. So the reason that we was thinking of the safety route of going through the inland tracks to get to this patient was that safety third, but the mission was we have to go, so we have to go now. So the only route that we did have was that inland track until we got back onto a beach and then forced our way up there to the top of the island, and then eventually got the guy flown off, and that took all of 35 minutes to get him flown off the island into Harvey Bay Hospital, which is a 10-minute flight time from the scene. So, yeah, there you go.
So 5 hours to get there and 10 minutes to get to the hospital. I guess, you know, when you're in that kind of environment, with which most of us haven't been, your perspective is very different, especially in terms of situational awareness. So, Jamie, we haven't heard from you. Any thoughts or questions from you so far?
I'm just sitting here in the background waiting, letting the experts speak. This is pretty fascinating stuff, and it's interesting to hear everybody in different parts of the world kind of bring up different things that they're dealing with, although I think the approach seems similar. And I think Sarah has a question. Sarah, why don't you go ahead? Sarah, are you muted?
Sarah Francis, you're muted.
All right.
Hi. I'm there she is. Sorry.
There you are. Good.
Here I am.
We do it all the time.
Is, what are the expectations of your patients who are in those environments? Are they expecting more immediate care, or are they okay with the longer arrival time of your EMS system?
Is that one to me?
Yes, that's to you, Swampy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Fraser Island only has a permanent population of 200 people on that island. But as I say, we have an influx every day of thousands of tourists coming to the island. The problem is with that is that they have this expectation that it's like being on the mainland. You dial 000 or 911 or 999, and they expect an ambulance to be on their doorstep within 10, 15 minutes of them making the phone call. They don't really have the concept of how difficult it is for us to get to them, especially when we have to do it either inland or on the beach because of the tide. They're on holiday. They're enjoying themselves. With holiday, some of their limitations are dropped as well, so we do deal with a lot of trauma on the island from people being bitten. The fact is, I'll just tell you, Fraser Island is the only place where they have now pure dingoes left in Australia. The dingoes are wild. There's signs everywhere saying don't feed them, but the tourists like to have a picture with the dingo. They're thinking it's just like a normal dog, but it's not. It's a red wolf. They try to feed them, or they entice them over, and they're wild and they become a bit bitey. So they do tend to take chunks out of people, and we have to deal with that. The sad fact is that dingo will end up being destroyed because of that. They then understand that they think, well, they've just had this lump taken out. We have to get to them, and then we've got to try and get them off the island. We only have ferries on one side, and at the bottom of the island, again, getting to those ferries is difficult because from one side of the island to the other is 2-hour drive by Land Cruiser. Or get them off by air as well, and then is arranging for that aircraft. But in the meantime, another job could be coming into the island, and so you've got to start doing that triaging process as well.
Chris, you have a question.
Yeah, that sounds like definitely quite an environment to be working in. I've got a question kind of for you for the I'm not familiar with the sort of initial training in EMS either in, you know, the UK or Australia. I know it's quite different than what we do here in the United States. But what kind of is taught as far as situational awareness, risk assessment, anything like that, sort of at your entry point into EMS there? I mean, for some context, in the United States, we basically are all taught to just have a yes, no question. Is the scene safe? Yes. Okay. Is it not? No, no go. I'm just curious to see if internationally, if there's a more sophisticated approach to risk assessment being taught or what?
It's with the situational awareness training that we get. It's an ongoing thing. We have training periods throughout the year, every quarter, and they always put a little bit of scene safety and health and safety into that training process just to keep up on it. But as I say, all the training now done for paramedics in Australia and I believe also the UK is all university based. During their 3 years at university, they would then come out and do practical experience with an ambulance service on the road. At this moment in time, I've got two third-year students working out of my station, and they're very good. They're very aware of what's going on. But again, it's their situational awareness because of their age, I would say, mainly is that they've gone straight from high school straight into university and haven't really got this real world experience, is limited to that. When I joined the service, I was 32 years old. I traveled all around Europe. I'd served in the British forces. And so my situational awareness would be a lot higher than somebody walking into it. But we also run a crew resource management thing with your crewmate. I have it with my crewmate, is my long-term crewmate now, that if one of us, just one of us says, I'm not happy with this, then we'll back away from it until we are happy with it. We also run a zero tolerance policy throughout the service that as soon as somebody becomes abusive to us or it is a dangerous situation, we just won't go into it until it is made safe.
Chris.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned the crew resource management. That's something that is pretty commonly used here in the United States in the air medical service. We, you know, have the, you know, with the pilot and both medical crew members, it's often, you know, it's three to go, one says no, you know, is kind of the model there. So all it takes is one person to say no, and that puts the aircraft on the ground and the mission's over. But it's great to hear that you're using that kind of system wide. I think it's a great model that we often talk about in this context.
Becky, we haven't talked to you. Any thoughts or questions?
I mean, this is probably going to be an obvious question coming from the meteorologist, but how does weather play into your risk assessment, particularly in situations that require, you know, an immediate decision? Are you looking ahead at what the weather is going to be as you head into the situation, or is it more like immediately short term what's happening right now?
For us on the island, if we request an aircraft, it has to go through the main call center down in Brisbane, and the people there who would task or not task the aircraft to the job. They mainly base that tasking upon the severity of the patient and the injury or illness. And then it's down to what aircraft is available, and then also if they are willing to fly due to the weather format. So they'll be looking at their METARs and NOTAMs and stuff like that for the weather. During the last cyclone, as I said, we get this septic patient out. We both looked out the window thinking it's a little bit windy. Maybe the aircraft is not going to go, but there's no harm in asking for it. And the aircraft was happy to fly. Say with the crew resource management, I use that from when I served on the aircraft. And teaching it to my mate as well at work. But the guys who mainly work on the island, because we have a close relationship with the air crews, because we're using them on a virtually daily basis to get people off the island, we can understand and look out the window and make that guesstimation to whether it's going to fly or not.
Chris, did you want to add on to that?
Yeah, it's sort of a comment and question then back to you is, you know, so in our flight program here, and I know what is common in a lot of flight programs in the United States is we get essentially a request for a flight without knowing, we know the destination, but nothing about the patient, and they won't tell us anything until we make a decision on their mission or not. So I was just curious, you know, the thought process there is to try to take that human element out of the decision making as far as your risk taking for flying or not. And so it sounds like that's not what you guys do. And I wonder if you have any questions or had any comments about sort of putting that into the mix as to whether the emotional aspect of what's going on with the patient, how that factors into your decision making process.
Yes, it depends on the paramedic, really, on scene. Some others would really try to justify on why they need that aircraft to get the patient off. If the people who are tasking the aircraft down in Brisbane deem that it's not severe enough for an aircraft to be done. But then we also, because of where it is on the island, majority of the time past 5 p.m. at night when the last ferry's virtually finished and gone, nine times out of 10, we will get an aircraft anyway, just purely for a geographical reason and not for a medical reason to get this patient off the island. Sometimes, though, they may say it's not worth flying it at night, putting that air crew in danger to fly at night. So we would bring that patient back to our station where we have a casualty room, and we can then start doing prolonged field care with that patient, monitoring and telehealth from there until the aircraft can then come and land at our surveyed land site, landing zone at the station, and then we can get that patient off in the morning.
Chris, you have more to add?
Question? Yeah, so I guess my sort of follow-up question is, so would there be scenarios where if the patient were more severely injured or ill, that they would fly in worse weather conditions for someone who was sicker than they would for someone that wasn't as sick?
Again, that's really down to the pilots on that decision-making. As you say, with the crew resource management, the cyber, if he says no, then it doesn't fly. It's as simple as that. And then we will then have to figure another way of getting that patient off. If we can't get it off by air, we do have in Australia the volunteer marine rescue, and we could scramble those guys and they will come across in some very severe weather. I've seen them come across to pick up a patient, but the boat that they come across on is very small and it is a very uncomfortable ride for that patient to go back. Worst case scenario is that boat can then bring over other medics for us, and we could get the police or one of the rangers that work on the island to go and get the medic and bring it to us, so we can then do more with that patient and hunker down and wait for the weather to break for the pilots to choose to fly.
Dr. Joe, have you taken anything away from this conversation?
Well, your timing is perfect, Sam. So I was just thinking how much this sounds like military special forces approach toward the extended field care, and in many cases, relocating the patient to a safer zone, whether that's from weather or a threat from an enemy of some sort. So it's modeled after that very closely. And that I've also had an opportunity to spend a fair amount of time in the field with some of the EMS services in Australia, and was supremely impressed with their managerial network. And by that, I mean the how incredibly efficient and well managed their resource management piece is. You know, when there's a request for service, it's all the things we've just been talking about obviously play into that, but you know, there are medics and dispatch that are helping to ensure that the right service and the right level of care gets to the right spot at the right time. And it's just such a well-managed system and managed in real time that I think U.S. systems could learn a lot from the great model that they have there.
So, Chris, what are your takeaways from this conversation? Did you learn something from Lee that you can use in North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the environment that he's working in is just it's astounding, and the challenges that just for a routine call that, you know, we take even in our, you know, wilderness areas are not nearly as logistically difficult to reach the patients as what they're dealing with. And, you know, I think that the concept of bringing that crew resource management into the field as a, you know, a great tool to use just on the ambulance is, I think, a fantastic takeaway, I think.
Absolutely.
Sarah Francis, do you have anything you'd like to add to what you've been listening to? I know you've probably got some things that probably came up as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good reminder of personal risk tolerance, because I think we become relatively comfortable in the environments where we work, and being reminded of those dingoes that can be a bit bitey on the other side of the world that I don't face every day would definitely lower my risk tolerance if I was just dropped into that environment. So it's, I think it's a good conversation for Safety Third, and remembering that everybody has this varying levels of risk tolerance.
This is Joe. I'm going to have to jump in on that because I am definitely going to use the word bitey from this point forward. It was awesome.
We love that. Yes.
Everything in Australia is a little bit bitey.
Biting dingoes.
People are very amazed when they say to us, you know, how many snakes here have you got to would harm or kill you? And we just go, well, every one of them. You know, and we've got 9 of the 10 most venomous snakes in the world that wander around, and we regularly go out to snake bites. And even on Fraser Island, there's snakes over there. There's the goannas. They're very bitey. And then there's all the little insects who would just like to take chunks out of you as well. So, yeah, everything here is out to get you.
That's just what I was thinking, Jamie. When we say snake, all of us think of Dr. Ben Abo, because he is our snake guru in this country. Well, we'd love to get you back on with him and have a conversation about all of those snakes. In fact, I've understood most of the critters, even the sea critters out there in Australia, are pretty bitey and serious. So that might be worthy of another discussion. I think it would surprise people.
Oh, more than happy to come over and chat about that.
You know, it would be so cool if you could come and visit them in North Carolina, or they could go to Australia and experience your system. I see so much similarity in what you're doing, but I can see you have so much you can learn from each other. You know, maybe one day
I'll volunteer to go to Australia. That sounds good to me.
My hand's up to come over.
I could see this being the externship.
Very extra.
Yeah.
Well, Joe wants to go too. So.
Yeah, I'm actually in June going over and doing an AWLS course with Colorado University in Costa Rica with their med interns. I think the first year med students are doing their one down there in Costa Rica. So I'm coming over just to finish off some of the training for that as well. So, yeah, be passing through.
Well, Joe has been jumping from country to country doing his training. Maybe the two of you will end up in the same place one day and you can actually meet with each other, right, Joe?
Oh, I would absolutely love that. Yes, that would be fantastic.
Well, Jamie, I hate to see the end of this podcast, but I think everybody learned something from it. There were a lot of takeaways, and we can certainly do it again.
Absolutely. And I think that this is not definitely not the end of this discussion. I think we'll probably be having similar discussions as we kind of carry on learning about what goes on in other parts of the world and how they manage different aspects of the factors that affect safety in their locations, because everybody has certainly different tolerance levels based upon the logistical hurdles alone make things a little more difficult. And, you know, I'm thinking, Joe, you know, when you guys do the training with Paragon, it is, you know, the handling of logistical hurdles is one of those things you guys kind of work into the experiential training, because that all factors into patient management. I remember you talking about, you know, the confined space rescue you were working on a couple episodes, maybe about 6 months ago, we were talking about that.
Well, you're right, Jamie. You know, that's part of the reason I commented on Australia's system, because the part of what we pride ourselves on is trying to cover not only the clinical, the pure clinical aspects, but all the amazing logistics and management that go on behind the scenes to make austere medicine possible and beneficial and as safe as we can make it.
So if folks want to check in with you guys and find out about how they can get one of your customized experience educational programs into their system, where can they reach you?
Well, we would love to talk to folks about our premier educational opportunities. They can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or through our Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group, as well. And you can always get us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. Well, I hope folks follow up on that and get in touch with you guys and have an opportunity to do that. Lee, thanks so much for making the time to come on. I know it's, you know, while it's into the evening here, it's mid-morning for you, and I hope we didn't take up too much of your day.
No, that's fine. It's been absolute blast to be on here, and I say I'm going on duty in the next 2 hours anyway for the afternoon shift, and I would love to come back on for further discussions and chats and fun.
Yeah, I definitely think we need to have you back and talk about how you guys manage snake bites and things like that down there with Dr. Ben Abo on. I think he would probably enjoy that discussion to kind of pick your brain about what you all are doing. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. So thanks a lot. Chris and Sarah Francis, thanks so much for coming back on the show. You guys always have a standing invitation.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And Becky, you as well. Thanks for the weather update and your questions as well. I think it's been a great help. I'm not going to get everybody's social media information. We've got so many people here. I'm just going to basically put all that in the show notes when we get to it. But we will go ahead and get everybody on. But Becky, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for letting me listen in. This is a ton of awesome information, guys. So thank you.
Well, and since this started in the community, I'm sure we can take this conversation back over there. And we know that Lee's a member of that community because that's where this started. So hopefully we'll continue the conversation.
We absolutely will. And Sam, I think this just goes to show us that, you know, no matter where you are in the world, that you know, the things that people face, the adaptability of the EMS systems and the providers in those systems at whatever level they're at really seems to show how people can step up and make things work in difficult situations.
Yes, and wherever you are, wilderness medicine is always a challenge. And I guess we can safely say wilderness medicine is not our everyday medicine.